4CIB now presents The Law and You, proudly brought to you by Bell Legal Group, with a large team of highly experienced professionals. You can feel safe knowing that Bell Legal can help you with your legal needs.
And a very good morning to you, John Fradgley from the Bell Legal Group, back with you for another program of The Law and You. As with every Tuesday morning, this is your opportunity to get free legal advice. That's right, free legal advice. All we need you to do is get on the telephone. Our number is 55208888. That number again, 55208888. If you're south of the Tweed River, remember to put 07 in front of the number. Otherwise, you can just get in touch by calling that number, 55208888. We do, of course, have our email address, which is talkback@4crb.com. And in fact, we do have a question that came through by email that I made a brief mention about last week. Unfortunately, arrived in too late for me to include in the program last week, but I'll certainly be talking about that very shortly. Thank you to all the people who called in last week. Certainly made for a very interesting program. Bit slow in the start, but a huge finish. A lot of calls, which is, of course, what the program is all about. We like to answer not only your query, but we're hopeful that the information we provide to you might also help other people who are out there listening but unable to get to the telephone at that particular time. But it is about calls, so we need to get you to get on the telephone now, 55208888. I mentioned we had an email last week from Eric who said that he and his wife are thinking about moving into an over 50s residential resort in Queensland. And in reading on in his email, it's quite clear that the type of resort that he's thinking about is what are referred to as relocatable homes. And these have certainly become extremely popular over the years. There have been many new ones that have been established with very sophisticated and luxurious, not only luxurious homes, but also luxurious facilities in these particular relocatable park estates. And of course, there are many others that have been around for a long, long time as well. But what Eric is primarily concerned about is what happens if the site owner goes broke and is unable to continue to provide the site services, the provision of amenities, etc., and what protection is there, in fact, available in these circumstances. And it's actually quite a good question, because I did a little bit of research in relation to it, and in circumstances where the owner actually goes broke, there doesn't appear to be any substantial protection that is readily apparent under the relevant legislation. There is protection where the park owner decides that they're going to terminate the site agreement because they wish to use the residential parkland for another purpose. And in those circumstances, they have to apply for QCAT, to QCAT for a termination order, which QCAT can make an order to pay the homeowner compensation, and that's got to take into account the estimated costs of removing the home from the site and including the costs of dismantling, moving the homeowner's belongings and any other relevant orders. Now, obviously, that would include, or one would think that that would include, moving the relocatable home to another suitable site. Now, QCAT does have the power to postpone any termination order for up to a year after the day on which, or any the termination date for up to a year after the termination order is made. And there is also the possibility, with the homeowner's consent, that QCAT can order that the relocatable home be removed to another site within the park that is comparable if both parties agree. But enough of that. We've got a couple of callers online. I will come back with a few more comments on that if time permits. But we say a very good morning to Michelle. G'day, Michelle. How are you today?
Oh, good morning, John. Good, thank you.
How can I help you today?
I had a pre-settlement done yesterday on a property we're purchasing today. Mm-hmm. And the owner lives in Melbourne, dealing through a solicitor. And we found that the place was dirty. It had tenants in. Mm-hmm. Could you tell us what are our legal options here? I've sort of told the real estate agent when we did a pre-settlement inspection that, you know, the place was pretty dirty. Yes, and I was just wondering, please, John.
Right, well, it'll depend on the terms of the contract, Michelle, so what the contract says in relation to that. I have a recollection. I don't deal in property law myself. I haven't dealt in that area for quite some years, but my recollection is that the property at the time of settlement should be in substantially the same condition as it was in at the time that you inspected it. So if the place was reasonably neat and tidy at the time you inspected, then it's not unreasonable to say that the place should be reasonably tidy, clean and tidy at the time of settlement. I think the best idea would be to get your solicitor. Well, there are two things that stand out to me. The first one is that normally when a tenant leaves, there's an obligation under the tenancy agreement for there to be a post tenancy inspection, and the property is required to be left in a clean and tidy condition by the tenant when they terminate the tenancy. So if the agent that sold you the property is the same one that was dealing with the tenancy...
No, unfortunately they're not, John.
Right, okay, so there's a slight problem there because someone's going to have to speak to the agent who was dealing with the tenancy and find out why that wasn't done. And then the second thing would be for your solicitor to speak with the solicitor for the vendor, explain the situation, check the obligations under the contract, and also the obligations of the letting agent who was letting the property, because what you're trying to do is basically put the obligation back onto the owner of the property that it should be left in a reasonably tidy condition. What often happens in these situations, Michelle, is that there's an agreement that a certain sum of money will be deducted off the price so that the clean can be done. That's normally what a seller would prefer to do, so that they basically can walk away from it and say, well, it's no longer my problem.
That's it. Perfect. Thank you very much. Have a lovely day, John.
And you the same, Michelle. All the very best. And the time on 4CRB just keeps rolling along, and it's just coming up to 13 minutes past 9. And, of course, that's 13 minutes past 10 south of the Tweed. Hello, Daylight Saving, and hello, Tweed Heads. We say a very good morning to Alan. G'day, Alan. How are you today?
G'day, John. I'm all right for a young bloke.
Yeah, good on you.
I'm only 79, so I'm pretty young.
79 years young. You haven't got the OBE yet, Alan.
No, I don't get old till next year when I turn 80.
How can I help you today?
A couple of months ago, I had the pleasure and honour of talking to your Margaret Miller.
Yes.
She would have to be one of the kindest, nicest person I've met in my life, and I mixed with a lot of business people.
Well, thank you very much for saying that.
I'm giving your company a free plug. When Lex hands out bonuses, Margaret should be on the top of the list.
Well, I'll certainly convey back to Margaret your comments, Alan. She'll certainly be very appreciative of that. I've certainly noticed working with her over a long period of time that she does have a very kind heart when it comes to dealing with people who are in difficulty, and she certainly takes on her clients' problems as if they were her own, but most importantly, remaining objective to the problem, which of course is what you need when you're seeking legal advice.
I went in to see her with my tail between my legs, and I skipped out after I'd been there. I can't say enough accolades to that lady. She was fantastic. I'm sorry I haven't rung earlier, but I've days and everything just haven't got around to it. I went bush, as she suggested, had a ball out there, but I'd like to give her and your company once again a free plug.
Well, thank you very much, Alan.
Nothing, but thank you very, very much.
Okay, Alan, all the very best to you too, and I hope whatever the problem was that you had, it sorts itself out promptly. All right then. Time on 4CRB is just coming up, just passing 15 minutes past 9 past 10 on the Tweed. The Law and You is the program. We presently have no callers online, so if you have a question or a query, give us a call right now. That number is 55208888. Just getting back, though, to Eric's email that came in last week about relocatable homes, and it was interesting to note that there is a difference between the legislation in Queensland and the legislation in New South Wales. There appear to be more protections in New South Wales for people who acquire relocatable homes. That being said, I think there are a few things that I certainly think that they are a very popular form of living for people, and I've known a few owners of relocatable homes, and I've never actually heard of a relocatable home park ever going broke. And one of the reasons for that is that I think that they are a highly profitable business, because when you think about the small area of land that you actually rent off the owner of the park, and the amount that you pay in site rent, which, depending on the park you're in, a lot of the ones that I've dealt with are between $150 and $200 a week. When you multiply that by the park, it doesn't take a lot to work out that they are hugely profitable ventures and therefore unlikely to get into financial trouble purely based on the running of the park. That's not to say that the owner of a relocatable home park couldn't get into trouble with other business ventures they have, particularly if they've provided the park as collateral security for those business ventures. But thinking that through, assuming that the park did get into financial trouble, or that there was a mortgagee who decided they were going to sell up the park, undoubtedly the mortgagee would keep the park running because there's money coming in. And secondly, the zoning of the park would more than likely ensure that the park was sold as a going concern to someone who's going to continue running the business. So to that extent, one should feel reasonably comfortable. Obviously, you can do a search of the title of the park to see if it's mortgaged. You could ask the park owner to have a look at their books, their financials, but given that these are primarily run by private companies, I wouldn't be surprised if they refuse to allow you to do that, because there's no obligation to do so. As I say, if the park owner wants to terminate, then there is a requirement for the payment of compensation. The other thing too to bear in mind, of course, is the zoning, because these parks are often zoned for their very purpose, and therefore any change in use, for example, to build a high rise or something of that nature, would require rezoning. But enough of that. We have another caller online, as we say, a very good morning to John. G'day, John. How are you?
Yeah, thanks, John. Just a quick one. I did get back to you on a blood trust situation.
Yes.
Some time back. John, an ordinary trust.
Yep.
And cutting away anybody else that might try and get into the estate of a person, the difference between an ordinary trust and a blood trust is it only in the is this something that's got a copyright on it, a blood trust, or is that something similar?
Well, I assume here you're only talking about testamentary trusts. So you're not talking about inter vivos trusts you set up while you're alive.
Well, hang on, just word is a blood trust.
Yeah, no, I understand that. But are you only talking about trusts that are set up under a will?
Yeah.
Okay, so if you're only talking about a trust that's set up under a will, then you have the common term is testamentary discretionary trust. Now, what you're talking about is a bloodline trust, and that's purely in how the trust, who the beneficiaries of the trust are. So if the trust is set up that has wide beneficiaries, so it includes, for example, the spouse of a primary beneficiary, it includes the nieces and nephews of primary beneficiaries, etc., it goes out to a wide group, then that's what we refer to as a testamentary discretionary trust. if you're looking at a bloodline trust or a testamentary trust that is limited to the bloodline, then as the name suggests, that will only provide for beneficiaries who are within that bloodline. So that will, the beneficiaries in that, for example, would be the primary beneficiaries might be your children, the secondary beneficiaries might be your grandchildren, and so on. So, and it might in fact even go down to your great-grandchildren, but it's clearly limited so that there can be no outside beneficiaries that can come in to that terminology or to the provisions of the trust.
Fair enough. Has somebody had a go at trying to get into it?
No.
Am I going to get a bit of few bob out of it?
No, I've not had any experience of someone endeavouring to attack a bloodline trust to obtain a benefit out of it. The area where you need to be very careful is in relation to who the trustees of the trust are, who the appointor or principal of the trust is, because that's the person who has the power to change the trustee. So as long as those roles are independent, the more independence there is in the trust, the less control there is to the primary beneficiary, the more likely the trust is to be to fulfil its purpose. Bear in mind that the Family Court of Australia has wide powers in relation to trusts, so they can go behind trusts and make orders that affect trust property. But there have been a number of decisions by the courts where testamentary trusts have been set up and where the court is satisfied that there is total independence of the trustees, the appointor, and the beneficiary. So it is quite clear that, assuming it's the primary beneficiary who's the one who's embroiled in the property dispute for family court purposes, where the court is satisfied that the primary beneficiary has no effective control of the trust, then the trusts have been held to be valid and the assets not capable of attack. Now, that's not to say that the family court would not regard the assets within that trust as a financial resource of the primary beneficiary. So in relation to the property that the primary beneficiary owns in their own right with their spouse, the court may make a larger order of property that they as a couple own, or that the primary beneficiary owns in his own right, having regard to the fact that the primary beneficiary has the financial resource of the potential financial resource of these assets in the trust, but the orders will not touch the assets in the trust.
Oh, fair enough. So it'd be my three kids that'd be the three trustees.
Right.
And if I wanted only to have two out of the three of them, would the third one have any, even though being a bloodline, but he's not a trustee of the trust, have any way to get into? He would be paid out by the other two trustees, my other two kids. Yeah, the third one's a bit of a question mark as to a problem, you know.
Yeah, the thing you've got to be careful about is to ensure that the trust is administered equitably, so that the two trustees, the two children who are the trustees, don't use the trust for their benefit as opposed to the benefit of the third child.
No, equal shares, John.
So if you set up three testamentary discretionary trusts, you need to make sure that there is more than just one beneficiary of each trust, because otherwise a trust that only has a sole beneficiary, well, that's pretty much the property of the beneficiary. So there are a lot of issues that go into setting up these trusts, John. And it is very, very advisable to get sound legal advice on the establishment of those trusts, particularly having regard to your personal circumstances. So it's not a one-size-fits-all. It's a case of going through your individual circumstances quite carefully and then tailoring the trust to ensure that it maximises the protection that you're wishing to achieve.
Oh, that sounds great, John. Thanks very much. Thank you.
Okay, John, all the very best. And the time on 4CRB is just coming up to 24 and a half minutes past 9. That's past 10 on the Tweed. We'll be back after this word from our sponsor.
Bell Legal Group is the Gold Coast's longest established law firm. Their highly experienced team of professionals can provide assistance in wills and estate planning, property law and conveyancing, family law, business and commercial law, and much, much more. Contact our sponsor, Bell Legal Group, on 5597 3366. That number again, 5597 3366. Or learn more about what they can offer at belllegal.com.au.
And this is The Law on You on 4CRB. The time is 25 minutes past nine, which means we only have 5 minutes to the local news. If you have a question or a query, we presently don't have any callers online, so you'd be able to get straight through on that number, 5520888. You may remember last week that I was talking about the Small Business Ombudsman and just making the point that the services of the Small Business Ombudsman are available for intercompany or inter-business disputes, and also disputes between business and government agencies. So it's quite a useful tool where the parties are willing to engage the services of the Ombudsman to endeavour to reach a resolution, certainly a far cheaper way of achieving an outcome than going to court. The other one to bear in mind too, of course, are both the State and Commonwealth Ombudsmans and the Australian Financial Complaints Authority, which deal with bank and insurance complaints, so if you have any complaints in that area. But enough of that, we have another caller online, as we say a very good morning to Benji. G'day Benji, how are you today?
John, how you going?
Going well. How can I help you today?
I've been working at the same company for about 7 years now. Mm-hmm. When I started, I was brought in part-time just after I finished university. So I'm not sure if you're familiar with employment law or not, but...
A little bit.
I was brought in just as I was finished uni, starting part-time. Mm-hmm. I've moved to full-time in the company and I've been there for 7 years. Mm-hmm. My contract, obviously... I signed something, you know, when I started as part-time, but there was nothing signed when I moved to full-time.
Mm-hmm.
I was just wondering, you know, what are my rights as in regards to requesting, you know, look at my contract that's current or getting access to my contract that's current. I was just wondering, you know, what the go is with that.
Right, okay. Well, if you have gone to full-time and you don't have a contract, then your employment would be under the relevant legislation. So it would be covered by whatever award covers your position, and you would be also have protection under the Fair Work legislation as well. So it's not essential to have a contract. Because if you don't have a contract and you are a full-time employee, then the terms of your employment and how you can be dismissed, etc., are covered by the award and the Fair Work legislation. So if the situation is, as you say, that you're now a full-time employee but you don't actually have a contract, you could ask for a copy of your original part-time contract that you had when you first joined. I suppose there's a possibility that under that contract it covered you going to full-time. Were you not given a copy of it at the time that you started?
No, I wasn't given a copy at the time I went to full-time.
All right.
But there is, you know, like I have a company vehicle, there's, I was just wondering if the same things apply to me as like a non-compete. Kind of clause, you know, in the original 6 month contract, because now I'm obviously in a different role. I was wondering if that would kind of apply.
Yes. Well, look, it's very difficult to answer in the space of this program, Benji, because obviously it would really require a look at the original contract you signed. What I would suggest you do is perhaps give the Fair Work Commission a call. Do you want me to give you their number?
No, it's fine. I'll look it up.
Well, I've got it right here if you want it.
Okay, yeah.
So it's 1-300-799-675.
Yep. Perfect.
Okay, so if your original contract no longer exists, no longer applies, then obviously the terms of that contract would no longer apply to you either. And normally under the legislation, there is no restraint of trade, but there is certainly a restraint in relation to removing or taking intellectual property of your business, so taking details of of the customers that you're dealing with, etc., things of that nature. So you need to be a bit careful about what you're doing. But I would suggest in the first instance that you have a work to the Fair Work Australia Commission, or they may in fact refer you to the Fair Work Ombudsman. But have a word to them and just see how they can help you.
Perfect. Thank you very much.
Okay, Benji, all the very best. Well, that's all the time we have today for calls. Thank you so much to those people who've called in to make for such an interesting program. I'll look forward to being back with you next week for another program of The Law on You. But as always, until then, it's goodbye and God bless.
You've been listening to The Law and You, proudly brought to you by Bell Legal Group, the Gold Coast's longest established law firm, helping Gold Coasters since 1955. Call them today on 55 97 33 66.